Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Rich Savin-Williams. Savin-Williams is a professor emeritus in developmental psychology at Cornell University. He is also a licensed clinical psychologist and has served as an expert witness on same-sex marriage, gay adoption, and Boy Scout court cases. He is author of 8 books on adolescent development, including his groundbreaking 2005 book, The New Gay Teenager, which we covered in an earlier interview. His most recent book, just released this fall, is called Becoming Who I Am, Young Men on Being Gay, and it was published by Harvard University Press. And welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Now, this new book, Becoming Who I Am, seems to underline a more complex world than the old world that you chronicled in The New Gay Teenager. But the kids seem to be on still the same trajectory of a pretty positive life. Are you surprised by this?
I'm not at all surprised. I think that over the years, we have tended to emphasize the pathology almost of gay youth. And that was one reason why I published the 2005 book, was to try to correct that. But that's been a decade ago. Mm-hmm. And so I began to wonder, like, what is life like for today's gay youth? And so I decided I needed to ask, and I needed
to... But you went to different people, though, right? You didn't go to the same kids that you interviewed.
Oh, no. These are very, very different. They're 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds.
Yeah.
And my idea was to find out what is life like now that they're living in a much more positive culture, things have happened for them. And so this was my attempt to... You know, I read the literature, the research, and that's helpful. And this book does try to summarize some of those basic ideas. But I also wanted to listen to the youth themselves to see what life is like.
Yeah, and you interviewed 40 young men.
Yes.
In their teens up to about the age of 20.
Yes.
And, you know, in most cases, it seems like they're leading very positive out lives and, you know, not hidden, ashamed like in the past generations, which to me is quite remarkable. Even
yeah.
In schools, you know?
Yes, it's sort of when I look back on my own growing up years, this is radically different. And I think that it seems to me over the years that especially after The New Gay Teenager came out, that I began receiving emails from kids who would say, you know, thank you for telling a different kind of a story, because we've heard about and we've read about the suicidality, the depression, the anxiety, the homelessness, the drug abuse. And they said, this doesn't fit our lives. You know, we understand that these kids exist, but how typical is this of our generation? And they were basically saying, no, that's the aberration almost,
mm-hmm.
and that what we want to have told are our real stories. Like, what is today growing up gay? And so that's when I decided, okay, I need to stop the research for a while and
let them speak.
Yeah. And so this is what I did, interviews usually lasting at least an hour, sometimes 2 hours, and then just had a series of questions about their lives. And
you know what I found very helpful in this book, too? It was your narrative. You know, filling in some of the history, some of the stereotypes and all the stuff that we're trying to eradicate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's still a mystery why some people are gay. We still don't really know, but we are eradicating the controlling mother and the absent father and right. the abuse from the uncle, right? I mean, talk to us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. In fact, there's one chapter called Why Am I Gay? Because that's a question that I get. And some of these guys at some point in their life, they did think of that. And then they began understanding, well, it's probably genetics, or it's probably something in the prenatal environment, hormones, or whatever. But it appeared to me that after a while, the reaction of them was, I really don't care. You know,
yeah.
I am who I am, and how I got this way. It's kind of interesting, you know, like a head game. But in reality, it doesn't really matter. And they think pretty much if it matters to other people, then those people are on the wrong track. It doesn't matter how I got this way. It's just me. I'm just
yeah.
normal. I'm just the way anyone else is.
Yeah, I think a lot of people use that as a political issue so that mm-hmm. they can build on it in some way. You know what? We know the world has changed so much when Exodus International closed its door after mm-hmm. 30 years. People might know that, but they're the religious group who tried to convert gays into being straight. And the president even apologized.
Yes.
That's how different the world is.
Yes. And I think a lot of these attempts to convert gay youth to straightness, they still exist. I'm not saying they don't exist. But mm-hmm. I think that most people are beginning to say that's not going to happen. And even if it could happen, where's the evidence that it is a good thing outside of some right-wing, you know, ideology, religious often? So I think that a lot of the young men I interviewed had never attempted conversion therapy. They never wanted to. No one ever really pressured them mm-hmm. into doing it. And so they just thought, well, that's kind of a weird thing that those religious nuts are attempting to do.
Yeah, yeah. Adding abuse onto what are now pretty normal lives, it seems, which I was so thrilled to see this. Mm-hmm. Now, but there are still some taboos. I mean, you talk about how very young boys still have a hard time discussing crushes on other boys. Mm-hmm. So talk to us about the little, smaller kids.
Right. So one of the things I was interested in is, because I'm a developmental psychologist, I want to know sort of developmentally, what were the important milestones in their life? And how did they think about how they negotiate that? And so a lot of them do recall, when you ask them, and which we almost never do, like, what is your earliest sexual memory? And a lot of them could recall sort of crushes on other boys, or maybe some level of sex play or being aroused. And they didn't understand it at the time, mm-hmm. but they just felt natural. It just felt normal. But then as they got older, then they began to understand that that might not be so normal or so typical or even desirable. So clearly there are messages that are still being delivered, I think especially to young boys prior to puberty, that we still don't believe that they are pre-gays. We somehow think of them as just being almost sex neutral, if you will.
Yeah, yeah.
But the stories belie that. I mean, all of these guys could remember same-sex sexuality or romantic ideas or fantasies from a very early age, long before puberty. So clearly sexual orientation doesn't begin at puberty, but is there. And I think we're still, as a culture, extraordinarily hesitant to even entertain the possibility that kids can be something other than heterosexual when they are young.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we all of us have heard that thing, they'll grow out of it, about any kind of behavior that whoever is in charge doesn't like, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you also found that about half the young men you interviewed had girl crushes. But it wasn't the same to them. They could tell there was something missing, right?
Absolutely. Some of them had girl crushes because they really liked a girl. And what they thought was that whatever they were feeling was equivalent to what straight boys were feeling towards girls. But once they recognized their boy crushes, they really begin to realize there's an emotionality about the boy crushes. There's something that just grabs them in a way that the girl crushes didn't, though they loved the girls. I mean, they loved spending time with them. And it also, for those who were troubled by their sexuality, clearly it served as a cover, if you will, because how could he be gay if he and Katie are so cute together?
Yeah, yeah. But I think he hit the nail on the head, though. It has to do with being emotional about your feelings about somebody, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the big difference.
Right. And, you know, though this book does not include bisexual guys, I have done interviews with bisexual guys, and that may be a later book. But bisexual guys obviously sort of recall these kinds of fantasies towards girls and boys. Mm-hmm. So they have, which can be even more confusing. But I think for the gay guys, they knew something. Now, whenever they would have these feelings that they wanted to always be with their best buddy, of course, family would say, well, yeah, boys will be boys. They can have fun together. All boys have boyfriends.
Exactly, yeah.
But it was different for these guys. You know, like when a guy moved away, they were crushed. They were devastated by the removal of this very important person in their lives.
Yeah, yeah. Not being able to put your hand on what exactly all this is must be scary, too. Mm-hmm. Now, you know what else surprised me about this book? That you still found that most parents don't teach boys about sexuality. They don't give them any information. Why is that still happening, Rich?
Mm-hmm. We have to remember that these are, for the most part, fairly highly educated parents. And it is very striking to me, and I can, and this is not just with gay boys, but youth of all sexes and all sexual orientations, is that parents simply do not talk to their child about sexuality except in the most general way or when it's way too late, that the kid has already sort of gone beyond what the parent is trying to say. I think parents just don't do that. They are really not in tune that this is a parental obligation. So then they say, well, the school will do it. But that's the school doesn't always do it.
Bad situation. They teach abstinence.
Right.
They don't teach anything about
and clearly very few sex education classes teach anything at all about gay sexuality. So that if anything is presented, it's always within a heterosexual context. So I think that the gay guys just sort of say, okay, where else am I going to be educated?
Well, you bring it up in your book how they get educated. A lot of them are being educated by pornography, which they find online now, much easier than the early days.
That's right. And every one of the guys has watched porn. And nearly everyone began at a very early age, right around pubertal onset. And it was very, very positive for them, which I think is not something we'd like to think about porn as being a positive element. But it was for them a way in which they could understand their sexuality. They could notice that they were watching the guys, not the girls, in the porn. Or they could understand, oh, this is what it's all about. So they were able to get rid of stereotypes. Now, they recognized that, of course, this is not sort of real sex, you know, in the sense that they wanted.
And everybody doesn't look like these buff guys.
That's right. They know that those bodies are distorted and so forth. So some felt like maybe they were watching too much porn. And so that was the negative, that some began to feel like, well, maybe I'm becoming more obsessed with porn than I should be. So it's not all positive.
Yeah, exactly.
I think there's clearly some negative elements. You know, they didn't see the emotional, romantic connection between the actors in the porn.
Yeah.
But it was extraordinarily valuable for them as an educational tool. Now, I'm not so sure that if I were to tell a group of parents, by the way, porn is taking over your responsibility as parents, that they would be very happy with that. But that is reality for these gay youth, and I'm going to generalize that and say that's probably true for straight boys and girls as well.
Oh, I'm sure of it. God. Now, you found that in spite of this porn education, that a lot of these boys really did want emotional ties with people they were having sex with, like the stereotype that especially boys just want to go out and be promiscuous.
Right.
But they really wanted emotional connections. That was interesting to me.
Yes, I think this is something that, unfortunately, gay culture has been a part of, is emphasizing the sexual part of gayness. And I think for these guys, if you were to ask them, you know, gave them a forced choice, would you rather have a soulmate, you know, the guy of your life, the guy that you're going to marry, the guy that you're going to grow old with and so forth, or hookups, sexual hookups, they would almost all choose having that romantic guy. Now, not all believed that was best for them or that they could ever find such a guy, but they were far more enamored, if you will, with finding a boyfriend. And some of the guys just simply said, hey, it's like the hookup sex is a tryout. You know, I'm trying to find the guy of my dreams, and they didn't know where else to search, and so they thought somehow the apps were the right way of finding such a guy.
Yeah.
But they wanted romance.
Yeah.
They really wanted romance, and that's what sparked their eyes, and they would talk at great length about their desires to find such a guy.
That's amazing to me because I come from a generation before that, and a lot of the guys I knew didn't want to get married. They didn't want to be anything like straight people, and you know, let's party. So I found that really interesting.
Right.
Now, one thing that I found missing in this book that absolutely flabbergasted me was that you didn't talk about the worry about AIDS or HIV very much in this book. Is that not a part of gay youth anymore?
It's gone. For better or for worse, because of the way that they understand AIDS as a chronic disease, and that it's not something they're going to die from, they believe. And they are now able to take various kinds of medications which are, you know, which prevent it. If it does happen, then it sort of does the medical thing. But it's clear that they are not nearly as concerned with it, and they don't really quite get it. They don't understand what our generation went through with the AIDS crisis. They understand it sort of intellectually, but not nearly as much as maybe they should.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rich Seven Williams. We're talking about his new book, Becoming Who I Am, Young Men on Being Gay. Now, let's continue that conversation about AIDS, though. Are young men encouraged to use condoms, like was emphasized greatly after the advent of the AIDS epidemic, even after the cocktails were invented?
I think that the vast majority of them, when I asked or probed, would say, oh, yeah, it's safer sex, of course. Mm. I mean, it was not even an issue of a debate for them. It's not to say that they were always 100% successful.
Oh, of course not. Yeah.
But on the other hand, the message has clearly got through to them. But I don't think it's so much AIDS that they're worrying about. It's more with STDs or sexual infections of various sorts. Mm-hmm. I think that is the kind of thing, and I'm not saying that HIV isn't one of those, but I'm just saying they don't worry about the big picture here. They're more concerned with some of the more what they consider to be the irritating aspects of having lots of sex.
Yeah.
And some of them do have. Some of these guys are very into sex, and some of them have a lot of it. But I think that the vast majority just don't see that's what they're all about, is to having as many hookups as possible.
Yeah, that really is a difference as far as I can tell. Now, coming out stories in the past generations, you know, often traumatic, involving abuse, parents kicking kids out. You didn't find that hardly ever in this book, at least. Did you meet any negative stories?
I certainly did find a number of the guys who felt like they went through sort of a rough period during middle school. That seemed to be the more difficult time period for them, where they did not see other gay kids in their school, in their middle school, and perhaps they were teased or bullied. More so if they were what we call in the field sort of gender atypical, that is more feminine than masculine. Those were the guys who got a lot of hassle. But then it was not about sexuality. It was about their gender expression. Mm-hmm. So even straight guys who are not masculine enough got the same kind of bullying that a gay guy would get. So it wasn't a matter of sexuality. A number of them had some rough time there, but in almost every high school that they went to, they did not receive that level of bullying, and they didn't see other gay kids either receive it, because by that point, most of their peers were really okay with gender and sexual diversity, and most of the kids just sort of said, no, this is not what we do. And for some, if they did receive it, they had straight allies who would actually defend them and say, hey, let's stop that kind of language. So I think the kind of abuse that we think is routine, that forces kids out of the home to homelessness and all sorts of things, I'm not saying it doesn't occur.
Yeah, yeah.
It certainly does occur for way too many kids. But I think that to believe that that is the majority experience of kids growing up today gay is just wrong. Maybe there's 10%.
God, that's amazing to me. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you attribute this to as a psychologist? Do you think it's because there are positive characters on TV and the gay marriage thing has happened? Mm-hmm. What changed the whole culture? It seems like it did.
And it happened in a very short period of time. And I think that there have been a lot of people who have speculated about what happened. I certainly think the AIDS crisis was a major issue which sort of sensitized people to the humanity of gay, lesbian, bisexual people. But I think that the media played a really critical factor here in portraying gayness as an acceptable, fun, diverse kind of an expression. And I think that as these things began to roll one on top of the other, as singers, TV shows, movies, then people started coming out, and some of these people were very high esteemed. And I think it just sort of step by step by step. And of course, we can't ignore some of the major issues, I think maybe beginning with Bill Clinton as president, when he began appointing out gay people in his administration and eliminating gays in the military ban. And I think that these kinds of events just kept piling on. And I think that the political action of gay adults was just absolutely important. And there are just so many heroes around who really pushed
it. We have to remember, though, I mean, Bill Clinton did appoint a lot of gay people, but he also enacted Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So there was a mixed bag. But it was the beginning of role models in many ways, in important jobs. And then Glee and, you know, all these shows that started. It's amazing to me how many positive characters are getting away from the stereotypes, you know.
Yes, we began to see gay people as almost like heroes, as very positive characteristics. And there's just a new article that is out that I find fascinating, in which the author argues that there's actually gay capital, that it's actually an advantage to be gay, and that you can actually gain extra prestige or extra friends, that there are people out there who want a gay friend because it adds something to their life or contributes in some ways, whatever.
Gives people a new perspective.
Exactly. But who would have ever thought growing up, for me, in my generation, that this would have been something that would have been desirable, to have a gay friend?
You know, you didn't talk that much about the fact that marriage is available. I mean, when I was growing up in the gay communities in San Francisco and stuff, nobody wanted. I mean, most people didn't want to deal with marriage. Mm-hmm. We want to be unique. We want to have our own creative lives. We don't want to be like straight people. How has gay marriage changed? Mm-hmm. Or is it just like the norm now?
Nearly all of these guys wanted a husband. They saw their lives eventually as leading to that kind of a relationship. Now, some wanted multiple husbands, or some wanted different kinds of rules of what marriage might be, but they didn't want it to be deceitful. They wanted to be very upfront, very honest about what it is that they wanted and what the relationship should be. But they now, I mean, this is, you know, almost, you know, causes me to cry. They now just simply assume marriage, which, you know, there's a part of me that goes, wait just a minute now. This is a new privilege. But another part of me says, I am so happy that you can just make this assumption. Now, do we know that we'll always be there? Well, the skeptical person in me always wonders, you know, will it be a guarantee?
Stone, yeah.
But I think we've advanced so far. I mean, who could have imagined 60% plus of American people, you know, that are in favor of gay marriage?
Yeah, this is remarkable.
Absolutely. Or same-sex marriage, I should say.
Do you find, though, that some of these gay youth aren't as colorful and aren't as, you know, flamboyant, obviously, probably most of them, but that there was something fun and free about the pre-AIDS, of course, that seems that everybody's conforming now and, you know, doesn't look as fun as it used to.
Well, I think the difference is our spotlight. Mm. I think that those kids still exist. But I think that in the past was the only spotlight that we had on gay youth, were those who were sort of say, shine it on me, shine it on me. And now we have this whole other huge cohort of youth who don't want the spotlight. In some ways, what they say is, no, I don't want to march in gay prides, you know, those kinds of things. And what they've done is basically to make their sexual orientation, their sexual identity, just another aspect of themselves. So they've really done a great job of integrating, synthesizing their sexuality into their personal identity. So it's not a big deal in the sense that it was for previous generations, where a young person might say, this is what I am, I'm gay. And you knew almost nothing else about his or her life.
Yeah. And I remember people, you know, toward the end of when the AIDS epidemic, when the cocktails started coming out and people started living through this, that people were saying they were sick of living in ghettos. You know, in San Francisco, they had Castro Street and a few places, and then you'd have to go act straight in the rest of the city, you know? So now the whole world belongs to all of us, more so, it seems.
Mm-hmm. I think so. It was significant to me when I asked them a series of questions that revolved around their involvement in gay activities. And at first, I was somewhat disappointed that they weren't more involved, you know, that they weren't protesting, that they didn't go to the resource center, they didn't go to the gay groups on campus. And it almost as if their gayness disappeared. But then I began to realize, well, isn't this sort of what we've been working for so many years? Mm-hmm. Now, not all would agree with that. There are those who say we should not, you know, sort of accommodate and become just like a straight person.
Yeah, yeah.
But the reality is most of these guys do want to be normal in the sense of the world in which we live in. They don't want to be outside.
Yeah, and they don't want to stand out and be pointed at. And
yeah, right. In fact, some of them had some very harsh words for those of their peers that they saw who made their gayness everything about themselves. And I did interview some of those guys. I mean, they're not absent from my guys, but it's very clear that they were in a very distinct minority in terms of the world in which most of these guys inhabited. And I think that's
important.
Where
were most of these guys from, anyway? What was the demographic? Is it New York, around the country? Where?
Around the country. They're not all just Cornell students by any means. I interviewed a number of people who were from another college some distance from here who had a very totally different kind of a demographic than Cornell students. And clearly, this is not a representative sample. I'm not saying that at all.
Yeah.
But I did not recruit them from gay organizations. Mm. Rather, they were just part of a larger study on sexuality and personality. And so the idea here was that I would just get guys who, you know, wanted to make $20 for the study and then
talk
say, oh, by the way, if you want to talk to me about, you know, your sexual and romantic life, I'd love to talk to you about it.
Wow, that's more interesting to me. I was thinking that you maybe put up leaflets and found just certain types who would want to do this. So what did you find are the obstacles? Why should some of these guys be activists and out there and marching? What's still left to do?
Well, I think that there is still a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of our willingness to accept that this is a lifelong development. That is, that this is present very early on. I think there still needs to be the kind of support and social service agencies for kids who are having trouble. I think some of that trouble is related to their sexuality, some is not. But I think that they have a very unique part of their lives that needs addressing that maybe our regular social services are not addressing. So I do think we have to be very concerned about that 5, 10, 15% who are not doing well, who are being bullied, who are homeless.
There's still a lot of kids who are suicidal as well.
Yes, yes. And I think that to characterize gay youth as suicidal, I think is wrong.
Yeah.
Not only is it wrong statistically, but it's also the wrong message to give.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that we forget about the kids who are, and that we pay attention to them and try to make whatever services are possible, clinical or public health, to help them lead good, solid lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we still need to do that. We can't give that part up, even as we welcome gay youth into all aspects of our lives.
So when you finished this book, you must have had this great feeling that the change has been positive rather than regressive, right? I mean, really.
Now I'm out of a job, you see, because everything I've been working for or really wanting to push, that is to put sort of, if you will, gayness back into our normal lives, both politically and social and interpersonally, it's occurring. It's occurring long before I ever imagined, but I'm thrilled that it is occurring.
Well, Rich Seven, we're almost out of time. Do you have any contact information in case anybody wants to get in touch or talk to you about the book? Or?
Well, certainly if you want to email me, you just do my last name, Savin, with a hyphen, Williams, @cornell.edu. And I respond to every email. So
that's great. Well, Rich Seven Williams, thank you so much for joining us. Again, I've been talking to Rich Seven Williams, a clinical psychologist and a professor emeritus in developmental psychology at Cornell University. We've been discussing his latest book, Becoming Who I Am, Young Men on Being Gay. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.